Hey, this is Daniel Tardy with the Entree Leadership Team. Thanks so much for listening to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. Hey, did you know that the lessons taught by Dave on this show are a part of our Entree Leadership Master Series event? If you want to hear the entire Entree Leadership curriculum, join Dave at our next Master Series event happening at Disney Swan and Dolphin Resort in Orlando, Florida, October 14th through the 20th. These tickets are selling fast and we only take 200 people. So visit DaveRamsey.com/EntreeLeadership or give us a call at 888-227-3223 to sign up today.
Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. On today's show, we will be hearing Dave teach about the momentum theorem. I know a lot of you have heard about that and wondered, what is that? He's going to be explaining that today and why that's absolutely important in your life. We will also have a special interview with international best-selling author Mark Sanborn. I love this. I love this because I had the opportunity to ask the ChrisLicurdo.com readers, what questions do you want to ask this leader, this author? So we're going to be talking to him in a little bit. Who am I? My name is Chris Licurdo, and I am your host for the Entree Leadership Podcast. Not only am I the host for this, but this is something that I teach. This is something that I do for a living. I will be at the Entree Leadership Master Series event in October in Orlando. Not only will I be teaching from the stage, but the reason why we do the Master Series event, the reason why it's a week-long event, is because we take that information and then we go past just teaching it. I will actually be spending most of my time in breakout sessions one-on-one with companies, tearing your business apart, teaching you about it, fixing it, finding the areas that need to be fixed, showing you things to do for the future. So if you're interested in that, make sure that you go to EntreeLeadership.com. Now, last episode, we talked to Joe Scarlett about the Golden Rule of Business, popular podcast. You guys like that one. We got a lot of responses off that. So that was fun. This week, this episode is going to be about the momentum theorem. The Entree Leader understands that momentum is no accident, period. It is created. Dave is going to share what the momentum theorem is and how you can start applying it to your business. So here is Dave Ramsey with the momentum theorem.
Momentum. Momentum is what every marketer yearns for. If you're smart, you want momentum. Momentum makes you look smarter and better than you are if you have it, and dumber and worse than you are if you don't have it. When you have momentum, you look like a freaking genius, and you're not. You look like everything you're doing is smart. You look like everybody thinks that you are the most unbelievable person on the planet when you've got momentum. They attribute attributes to you that have nothing to do with you. That's why we worship athletes that are winning. So-and-so becomes the number one football chunker, right? And we get all enamored with him because he can chunk a football. And then we're all distressed when we find out his personal life is a disaster. We attributed things to him that had nothing to do with him simply because of his personal momentum on the football field. People do that to you. They do it to me all the time. I got unbelievable momentum right now. If I wasn't me, I'd want to be me. And consequently, people think I'm way smarter, way cooler, way more spiritual than I am. I'll take it. But it's not the truth. When you got momentum, you're not as good as you look. You're really not. And if you start to believe your own press clippings, that's, you know, you're at the declining stage. That's what's going to happen. And so, but when you are just getting started, And everything you touch turns to manure, and you're just fighting and scrapping and clawing, and you just barely get your head above the manure to get a breath, and then you go back down in it. And everybody goes, he's not going to make it. But what happens when you're swimming in manure is you build muscle, and you churn it around enough, it becomes fertilizer to grow stuff. You know? That's the good part about, yea, though I walk through the valley. In the valley is where the fertilizer is. And that, you know, that's what's happening. You are better than you look when you're starting. You first get married, you're a horrible husband. But you're better than you look. You better than you think you are. When you have a business failure and you crash and you're laying there bleeding and beat up and cut and you've been fired from four jobs and you don't know what you're going to do, you're better than you look right now. Because now you got this thing called experience that you didn't have before. Experience is where you get judgment from. And experience is what you get when you don't have judgment. It's where it comes from, right? And so we make these attributes, but from a marketing perspective, we want the momentum. Now, here's what's funny about momentum. People in business, even some of the best marketers I meet, they seem to think it's random. That momentum just occurs randomly. It just happened. Woo, look at that momentum. It just visited us. Wow, the momentum fairy dropped off a can. You know? It's not how it happens. It's not how it happens. We had this happen a few years ago at our place. Oprah, oddly enough, today, they had on the front page of USA Today that she's, she says, it's done. Jesus said, it is finished. Boy, we worship this chick, don't we? It is done. Oh my gosh. USA Today, do you have no idea what parallels you're doing? The priestess. But anyway, so Oprah calls. It says, you know, we want you to come on Oprah. And we're like, and by the way, when Oprah was rolling about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that kind of thing, if you went on her show with a book, ding, 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 you had a number one. They called it the Oprah effect. Now, in the last 8 years or so, it's diminished. But prior to that, it was like ding, 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 everybody. I mean, I was going along. I had 263,000 copies. I was out of the gate. Susie Orman's first book came out the same month my first book came out. How weird is that? We started the same month, January 97. We're going like this. I took off, pastor, I'm going out through here. She gets Oprah and she goes, whoo, to another county, and I never saw her again. I mean, she went to 2 million copies just like that. It was amazing. Just instantly, never looked back until Oprah quit being her friend for a while. And then I had to go through all that stuff. But anyway, so Oprah would call us and say, you know, I had been on Larry King, I had been on Fox and Friends, I've been on the Today Show, I've been on Good Morning America, I've been on CBS, I've been on the 700 Club, I've been on this, I've been on the Nightly News, I've been on Nightline, I've been on everything except Oprah. I couldn't get on Oprah. No matter what I did, I couldn't get on Oprah. It was like this unbelievable. And they would call and say, well, we're thinking about doing a show. Would you send us some tapes and some content of what you would do if we did this? And we'd send them up some stuff. And then they'd call back, well, that looks pretty good. Send us some more about this and this. We'd send them up some stuff. We're starting to get excited. And they would tease us. And then we'd send them some stuff. And then they just wouldn't return our calls. They just don't call back. I'm like, Where'd you go? You were talking. Where'd you go? It's like a fish got off the hook. Got it almost to the boat. It's like, it's a big fish that got loose. So that happened like 6 times. They teased us. So our big joke around the office was we were the people who had almost been on Oprah more than anybody. So I did this silly little interview for This American Life on NPR. The lady that interviewed me, she was sitting in the studio with her little recording, her little DAT recording device plugged into the phone system, into the microphone. So she was getting the caller and me to be able to pull actual clips and do an edit because it's a radio show she was doing the story for. And this lady called from Chicago, and she starts describing how her live-in boyfriend won't let her go to the grocery store by herself. She's not allowed to spend any money. She has no control of no money, not one dime. He's complete control freak with the money. And I've worked with enough domestic violence situations. That's the number one indicator of domestic violence. Is a complete control of the finances. And so I happen to know that. Plus, I'm just listening to her and her verbal cues and the way she's talking about it. She's got 2 kids there. And you can hear the fear in her voice. I mean, it's palatable. And so it didn't take a rocket scientist to do this, but apparently she thought it did. So I just said, so how long has he been hitting you? Beat, 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 beat. He's not. Said, you just lied. And she started crying. How'd you know? And I said, here's what we're going to do. Laura's already on the move because Laura knows this stuff too. She's already got the domestic violence shelter set up. You are leaving that home in the next 10 minutes. You start packing. We're going to have them come pick you up. You're going to get killed if you stay there. Well, my kids, we won't have anything to eat. And the whole victim scenario, they go through all the same stuff. It's a verbiage they use. And I just said, darling, your kids are going to get killed when you get killed. He's going to kill you. You can't stay there. You're not a punching bag. You are leaving today. Uncle Dave is saying you're leaving. Do you hear me? Yes, Uncle Dave. Thank you. I'm so scared. I know. We're going to help you, darling. We had the domestic violence people. They got over there, got her out, all this stuff. And I turned around, looked at my lady, and she's going. So Leslie Stahl's riding along in New York. Here's this. She's in the back of her car service going to 2020 or going to 60 Minutes, and she hears this call, and she's going, I'm going to do a profile on that guy. We get this phone call from her on her cell phone calling us, and they want 2020 wants to do a deal on it. Okay. Yay, 60 Minutes is going to do a bid on us. Wait a minute, that's 60 Minutes. They're going to do a bid on us. Because, you know, they're not always known for being nice. Hello. So we spent the next 4 months with Leslie Stahl. We took all the furniture out of our living room so they could shoot across the room and get the little lamp of the way they wanted it in the background. It's all out in the backyard. It was unbelievable what these people used. And we sit in our living room. We did not have a viewing party because, you know, I don't know what they're going to say. They may take me to task. So we're all sitting there going, Jesus, 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 protect us. And 12 minutes, 100% positive. Not one zinger, because they usually at least go 11 minutes and a minute of zinger on the end, you know?
But his critics say, and here's George, who's never, you know, he lives in his mother's basement, but he's Dave's critic.
You know, they'll usually pull something in, right? But no, I mean, they just loved us. It was awesome. I mean, the web went bananas. The book sales took off. The book went to number one. It went to number one on Amazon. Ding, 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 ding. You could just watch it. I mean, it was, you refresh, and it's like refresh, 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 and then it just stayed there. Our servers are all trembling. You know, the volume is just coming in. My guys at Web are going, you know, fire, fire. You know, I mean, they're just, we're running around. We're all ready for this big hit, and I'm calling the office. Are y'all doing okay down there? It's going to run again on the West Coast. You got the volume handled? You know, it's all run down to the office. Now that it's good, and we know it's good, I'm celebrating with everybody. We're watching the various, and it's all, it took off, man. It was November. It went great. So about 3 months later, Oprah calls again. I'm like, who's this? No, I'm kidding. But so we, Beth, my talent, my PR director worked with her. We got her all going again, all this thing, and put it all together again, all this deal. And then they said, okay, we're going to do a show. And I went, oh my gosh, we're going to do a show. So we go up there in April and shoot the show. It's going to air in May, which means we have to call, you know, what the publisher, Thomas Nelson. They got to get on the phone with Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon. Everybody's got to stock up because, you know, Oprah's going to go, here we go again. You know, we just had this big hit with 60 Minutes. Now here we go again. Boom, right? And so there, we get all ready. And then they call and say, we've decided that we're not going to run the show in May. It's too good. We're going to run it in September. And I went, well, I'm thinking, I wish it wasn't so good because everybody's ready. Then we got to call Barnes & Noble and go, just kidding. You know, 600,000 copies, just kidding. And they weren't happy, but we convinced them September was a good thing. So they give us the date, September 13th. We start building our marketing and getting all the backbone, all the stuff ready, all the web, everything, get it all organized again. 60 Minutes calls and said it was the highest rating show we had last year, the one that had your segment on it. So during reruns this summer, we're going to rerun it. And so when? Last week of August. So I'm getting, you know, 60 Minutes again. 2 weeks later, I got Oprah. We called Larry King just because we didn't want him to be left out. You know, I mean, it was just like this thing. And so what happened inside of our company was our young crew started believing our press. And they're like, we're so smart. You know, we're awesome. Look at this. This is Oprah's discovered us. There we go. Ah! And it's just like lightning struck. It was so random. It all came together. God's blessings are random. Yes, God's blessings sometimes are random, but they usually follow an idea called you reap what you sow. The diligent prosper. And so I started going, guys, calm down. I've worked my butt off for 15 years. Now I'm an overnight success. This is not an accident. It is not random. Yes, the situation here and the organization of these particular dates seems to be random. We'll call that God's blessings, and they are, and the blessings of Oprah, too. Thank you, Oprah. And all of this, right? But all this stuff, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I'm trying to convince our guys that this is a process that got us to this level of momentum. And so we sat down and we said, okay, what do we view around our place? What's an entree leader call momentum? What does a momentum, how does momentum occur? Does it just happen? No, it doesn't just happen. The entree leader understands that momentum is no accident. It is created. And that is true in your life. It's true in your marriage. It's true with your kids. It's true in your spiritual life. It's true in your training for your triathlon. It is, you build up momentum. You go through a process and then it occurs. It is a cause and effect scenario. And it's true in marketing. We decided that momentum is this. The momentum theorem is what we came up with. Fi over T multiplied by G equals unstoppable momentum. Here it is. Focused intensity are the FI. You live in a culture where people don't stay focused. They can't keep their eye on one thing. The whole culture's ADD. And if you can decide to keep your eye on one thing, you can win. Focus is important. You've got to be focused. You've got to have that mission statement. You got to say, this is what we're doing. All these things are not what we do. This is what we do. And then you got to do it with intensity. You got to be fired up, man. I don't care which personality style you are and how your fired up looks, but you got to be fired up. When they look into the windows of your soul, into your eyes, they got to feel it. It's got to drip off of you. That's your customers, that's your competitors, and that's your team members. You got to get intense. Now, a lot of people can be intense for 20 minutes. A lot of people can be intense for 2 years. But if you can be intense for a decade, you'll become a national brand. If you can do focused intensity over time, you'll create momentum. You want to create unstoppable momentum? Take a finite set of mathematics, those of you who had a little calculus, and multiply it by the infinite. God. That's the G. Real momentum never happens quickly or easily. It always happens over time. Even with focused intensity over time, we as humans are finite, but God is infinite. And so develop a crusader mentality. Your product or service must flow from a calling, not merely from a job. You get fired up. You're focused over time. You multiply that by God. You create unstoppable momentum. This thing will go through the roof. You can create a level of momentum by yourself, but don't hesitate to multiply by the infinite.
For me, the most important thing about that theorem, about the momentum theorem, obviously, is the God part. So let me say the second most important thing. The second most important thing is that this does not happen overnight. The time issue, the time element of it is important for you to realize. If you want momentum, it's not going to happen next week. It's not all of a sudden just going to happen. Things that happen right away, all of a sudden, phase out quickly. This is something that takes time. You've got to be willing to be focused and intense for a long period of time. As you do that, then you start to get momentum. As you teach, as we were building entree leadership in the days, we didn't have large numbers showing up early on 8 years ago. As I started my blog, I didn't have large numbers showing up. This is something that I had to do every day, be intentional about for a long period of time. So folks, if you're anything like me, my personality style is usually, oh my gosh, if I put some effort into it for about the next 4 hours, surely it's going to be a windfall. Then that's going to be an important piece for you to understand. It takes time. Now, moving along. Today, we are talking to Mark Sanborn, author of 8 books, including the bestseller, The Fred Factor: How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary, which has sold more than 1.6 million copies internationally. His other books include You Don't Need a Title to Be a Leader, Team Built, The Encore Effect, and his most recent book, Up, Down, or Sideways: How to Succeed When Times Are Good, Bad, or In Between. So please welcome Mark Sanborn. Mark, it is so good to have you on the Entree Leadership Podcast.
Chris, great to be with you.
Thanks for doing this. I got to say that you are one incredible author.
Well, thank you.
You've got, is it 8 books that you've got out, I believe?
It sounds odd, but it depends how you count.
It depends on...
I've written 7 or 8 by myself and edited or contributed to quite a few more.
Okay. Well, fantastic stuff. And the one that I wanted to start with is the Up, Down, or Sideways, because that is, especially the way that things have been going the last few years, especially with, you know, with businesses, with economy changes, with everything that's been going on, you have written an incredible book on how to essentially succeed in any situation. But before we get into that, I wanted to start out with what you opened the book talking about the surfer concept and talking about what you call the Sanborn triad of trials. So tell a little bit about that and how you got through that.
Well, let's start with the surfing concept or the metaphor that says we are all affected by waves that we don't control. And just like a good surfer doesn't control the wave that he or she surfs on, you know, Mother Nature makes the wave. That surfer learns to interact with those waves to create the outcome that they desire. So I think that's what life does. Life throws us curveballs and creates waves that are sometimes pleasant and sometimes devastating and most of the time somewhere in between. Mm. And what happened to me in 2008, and this is the most personal book I've written, because believe it or not, I know people find it hard to believe that a speaker or an author doesn't like to talk about himself. I really don't like to talk about myself because... my work is about not what I learned, but what others can learn from what I learned.
Right.
And to the degree it's instructive, I do share personal stories that are illustrations that I think people can relate to. And I think a lot of people think, well, you know, if you're a successful author and you've owned your own business for many years, you don't know what it's like in the real world. You've never had problems and setbacks. Au contraire. And 2008 was that triple whammy because in addition to watching my investments get hammered by the markets, as most people who were in the market also experienced,
right.
My business had taken a hit. I had grown my business consecutively for over 20 years. I'd never had a setback until 2008, and we took a setback in the business, but I was dealing with both of those challenges while I was recovering from cancer surgery.
Now,
I know a lot of people... have business setbacks or sometimes financial and sometimes health. But boy, when you have all three simultaneously, that gets your attention.
So just to paint this picture, the economy's tanking. You're losing investments like crazy.
Correct.
The business, you make a living by speaking and teaching. And as someone who does the same thing, 2008 was not a great year for speakers.
No, because meetings were suddenly, you know, vilified. There were some wasteful meetings, but regrettably, all meetings came under scrutiny and budgets were slashed. And yeah, the meetings industry took a major hit, which means that people like you and I took a hit.
Yeah, so you're not your income's going down, and on top of that, you just happen to have cancer.
Correct.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but the reason I tell the story isn't woe is me, but because I had a certain sense of optimism and confidence. It was born out of a simple realization. You know, I think we know a lot of things in life that we simply forget. They get pushed to the back burner. Sometimes I believe that what I am is a professional reminder, as a communicator. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nice when I come up with ideas that no one's ever thought of or heard of before, but more often than not, what we're dealing with are timeless truths. And what I realized is that I had been doing many things that I'd learned from my parents, from others over the course of my life that had prepared me for that trifecta of trials. And I was optimistic going forward that I would not only survive them, but that I would at some point in the future be able to thrive despite them. And that's why I wrote the book, is to kind of distill what had I learned that had prepared me for those inevitable setbacks that everybody, if they live long enough, encounters.
I love the surfer concept because... I just don't think we look at life that way. You know, we don't look at life the way that the surfer does for most of us. And again, the people that are listening, we've got entrepreneurs, we've got leaders, we've got people who want to be leaders. We look at life as how do I change the ocean? How do I change that wave? How do I make that wave fit what it is that I want to do? And instead, what you've discovered, what you've realized is that's the ridiculous way to go about this. Instead, learn the wave, understand the wave. You know, you're not gonna know every direction it's gonna go or how it's gonna end up, but try to find the best way to utilize the wave to your advantage so that life comes out in a better way.
Well, I'd heard an interesting illustration from a professional mountain climber who talked about having crossed a section of the mountain on the climb with his team, and just a matter of minutes later, looking back and seeing another team from a different country behind them being swept off the mountain in an avalanche.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said something that absolutely I'll never forget. He said, I realized at that moment that I'm not in control, but things aren't out of control. And I think that takes philosophy and theology and faith and life and rolls it up into
all into one.
A very powerful concept that as much as we'd like to think we are in control, above a proactive personal level, we're not always in control. I'll give you an example of that. The cancer that I had was not born out of a behavior. In other words, it wasn't from smoking. It wasn't from some controllable thing that I had done. I've read that 40 to 60% of deaths are attributable to behaviors or choices that we make in our lives, right? Well, this was, you know, I came from a family that had a history of one kind of cancer. I was monitored for years. We did everything we could to prevent getting that kind of cancer, and boom, I get a different kind of cancer. And there's a certain irony in that, but the point of the matter is there's nothing I could have done differently to have avoided it. So when that happens, the question isn't, oh, woe is me, why, or what did I do? The question is, what do I do going forward? What do I do now? And for me, being pretty devoted to fitness, you know, I'm not fanatical, but I've always been a guy that exercises 6 days a week. That really gave me the physical reserves that enabled me to more quickly deal with the surgery and recovery from that particular cancer.
Yeah. Two things here, or what you're looking at. What happens with so many people? And one, I do not envy anybody who's had cancer. I hate that. But I think the thing I love about your story is that I do know so many people who go backwards. You've already got something that's horrendous in your life. You have this tragedy all of a sudden, and it hits them like a ton of bricks, and they stay down. You looked at it as, okay, well, I just got to figure out how to get around this thing. I gotta have to figure out how to get through it, how to fix it, how to change it, how to do whatever it takes to get rid of it. That is powerful, especially with what we're, you know, in the sense of the cancer side, but you have applied that to every aspect of your life. You came out of 2008, not just the cancer, your investments, your business, everything. And you rolled that up into what is up, down, or sideways. Correct. I mean, that's what the book came from.
Yeah, that's what it was born out of. And, you know, and Grace, in the book, you remember a phrase that I learned from my friend Cleve McCleary years ago. Cleve's a Marine, served in Vietnam, and he used to talk about the tremendous, devastating setbacks and tragedies they would experience. But the Marines have a phrase, and it's FIDO, and it stands for Forget It, Drive On.
Forget It, Drive On.
And I like to tell people that from a health standpoint, there is a grieving process. You know, I'm not a shrink or a therapist, but I do know, I've lived long enough to know that denying the pain or the grief that comes from a failed relationship or a physical or a financial setback is not a good strategy. You really need to deal with it emotionally. But the problem is when we get stuck in the feeling and we forget to drive on. You know, when we don't get past the, you know, there's a fine line between grieving and wallowing.
Right.
And boy, you know, I have a friend who, luckily, he's employed now. But he told me he had gone on 352 or some such job interviews, and I remember thinking first, maybe he needs a little coaching in job interviewing.
There's
that
an issue.
Aside, you know, that aside, you got to give the guy an A+ for tenacity, because most people probably would have stopped at around 50 or 100.
Yeah,
but he stuck with it, and I think that's what, you know. And I'm going to encapsulate the whole book, because it's funny. I don't even know that I use these words. You know, sometimes after you write a book, the book becomes frozen in time, words on a page, but the concepts continue to percolate in your head. I think what the book is about is my whole philosophy of hope. Hope is having something new to try and being willing to try it.
Ooh.
You're not hopeless if you've got something new to try and or you're willing to try it. I think hopelessness comes from people running out of ideas. You know, they run out of ideas. They don't avail themselves to the books and the wise people in their lives and the sages of history. They run out of ideas, or they have the ideas, but they run out of the emotional energy to try them. Mm-hmm. They just become so demoralized or depressed that they don't have the physical strength to implement the ideas. So if I can encourage people emotionally and give them practical, realistic tools, which is what I try to do in the book, then I think, in a way, I've been a purveyor of hope.
Absolutely. Well, one thing I want to say, I've always spent a lot of time reading people's books, getting their information to ask them some great questions. The other day, on chrislocurto.com, I decided to ask the readers what they want to ask Mark Sanborn, and it blew up. It was a lot of great questions came through. You jumped in, talked a little bit on there as well, so I appreciate that. So what I want to do is I want to go through what the listener, the people that are listening to this podcast, want to know from Mark Sanborn, and then at the end of this, we'll cut a little extra for the chrislocurto.com readers. Is that cool with you?
That's great. Yeah, I saw those. These were great questions.
I was very proud.
The woman who asked about my idea studio for leadership development.
I know. She said,
was one of my favorites because I thought, cool, you know, I mean, you know, sometimes we just go, oh, it must just be another slogan or gimmicky phrase. But she inquired, and I shared with her that, you know, studio, if you look at the etymology, goes back to studere in Latin, which means to study. It also has a synonymous meaning with zeal. So I like to put the two together and say that, you know, a leadership studio studies the art and science of leadership with zeal, and then we share our findings through speaking and books and advising. So I like that question, and I appreciate her for asking.
I loved it. And she's an artist, and so
I know. And, I mean, see, there's a great intersection. We don't have time today, Chris, or it'd be a four-hour podcast, but there's a fabulous intersection, you know, between art and science and leadership, and I think we sometimes forget that. We either go with one or the other and not both. And I personally favor both the art and science of leadership. Mm.
So let me start off with Jen McDonough. Jen says, as a leader, thinker, author, and speaker on leadership, how can someone go from being viewed in what society would consider a corporate non-leadership type position to someone like yourself who is a confident leader and teacher? Were there times you ever struggled with this transition? If so, what were the hurdles you needed to overcome, either internally or externally, and how did you overcome these? It's a big question.
It is a good question. Right now, it's very, very popular to pursue thought leadership. There are people out there that will teach you how to be, quote-unquote, a thought leader. And one of the things that I point out is that thought leadership is bestowed, not claimed. I mean, you can claim to be a thought leader, but that doesn't make sense. When someone else says, your ideas are innovative, your ideas are leading edge, your ideas are powerful, that's your first clue that you're a thought leader. So to kind of take a big question and capsulize it, I think that becoming a thought leader is about the quality of your ideas drawn from a depth of experience communicated well. I mean, a lot of people have expertise and experience, but if you aren't able to share with others what you've learned in a way that they can learn from it, you're just going to be a credible, experienced leader.
Right.
I think where most people make that transition, at least commonly, from a practitioner of leadership to someone who writes or speaks about it, is when they have some kind of forum where others get exposed to their ideas, whether that is speaking for free within your industry or profession, whether that's speaking to civic groups, whether that's starting a blog on the internet. Once people get access to your ideas, and if you're prolific and you continually build an audience that likes and uses your ideas, over time you'll move towards that positioning as a thought leader, and people will offer to pay you to come speak, or a publisher perhaps will offer you in advance to write a book. That's kind of the transition. You go from practitioner of leadership to a practitioner of leadership teaching by having a depth of experience and quality ideas. But the third part is learning to communicate them well. So people go, wow, that was great. I got some real value from what he or she wrote or said.
And as someone who writes a blog every day, that is one of the things I try to convince people. If you want to teach people something, you know, just like you said, start. Don't wait. Just do it.
Yeah, just get out there. The nice thing about a blog is if they don't like it, they just don't
read
it. But
they don't read it.
It makes you a better writer. I think Christopher Morley once said something to the effect that you write a book to trap your mind into doing its own thinking. And I think that that's what we do, is by writing and speaking, we start to verbalize and polish and hone our ideas. And there's value just in the writing and speaking, even if it isn't immediately received as wise or popular, because we develop the art of communicating. It's so funny, nobody gets on skis and thinks that their first run down the mountain is going to be successful. But for some reason, people think that when it comes to speaking or writing or consulting or training, that it's just a matter of, hey, I've got all these ideas, I'm just going to put them out there, and it's going
to
take.
They're just automatically good.
Exactly.
It is a muscle that you have to exercise. This one from Carol Dublin. I love the idea of good shoulds mentioned in the intro to Up, Down, or Sideways. My question for Mr. Sanborn is, how do you separate and tell the difference between all the shoulds to guarantee you are paying attention to the right ones? And go ahead and explain the shoulds.
Well, a good should is something that benefits you. You know, we sometimes push back against people telling us what we should do. But I point out in the book that good shoulds were the things that your mother and father taught you as a kid, like look both ways before crossing the street, brush your teeth every day, say thank you. Those are things we should do that benefit us and make us successful human beings. So I tell people not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just naturally resist when someone says what you should do. Now, I do think we resist when people become controlling.
Right.
That's not what a good should is. The key to understanding what a good should is to look at the principle, because all good shoulds, starting to sound like a tongue twister, Sally selling seashells down by the seashore, all good shoulds are based on timeless truth. Truth never changes. The only thing that changes is the application of truth.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, communication principles haven't changed, but the Internet's new and email's even newer. So what we've been challenged to do is find out how do we apply the principles of good communication about understanding and being understood, and how do we do that in a medium we now today know as email. So I would beware of anything that, and I think most of us have a sensor to gimmicky, faddish, get rich quick, trendy. Look for the underlying principle. If you cannot find an underlying principle that's been true across time and culture and context, then it's probably not a good should.
Hmm. This is from Aaron Nelson. My question is, how do you walk out your deepest time is bad moment? And have you ever had to deal with a time is bad moment that you caused yourself? If so, how did you deal with that?
Oh, I've dealt with a lot of times are bad that I've caused myself. I've had a lot of self-inflicted, you know, wounds from stupid choices, bad choices, dumb behavior. You know, we're all human, and I think the beginning point is, you know, to take responsibility. I always say that as a leader, you only get full credit when you take full blame.
Mm.
I think a lot of leaders like to take credit for the good things, but then explain away the bad things as being, you know, circumstance or someone else's fault. So it's about accepting responsibility, but really, I don't want to sound trite, but it's about changing what you can and accepting what you can't.
Right.
Again, I want to go back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, and that is, you know, you've got to deal with the emotional grieving process, but you've got to, in short order, start looking for the answer to this question: what can I do now? The other question I would ask myself is, what have I learned from this? Because the only thing worse than making a bad mistake that puts you in a bad place is to make the bad mistake twice in the same bad place again. And I think a lot of times we waste a good crisis or a tough time by not ever extracting anything from it. Back in 2008, one of the reasons that I took a really big hit in the market is because my very high-priced financial advisor advised all of his clients to get out of the market at the very bottom. He believed the market was in free fall. And, of course, believing that he was smarter than I, and in many ways he was, I took his advice. I'd never left the market before because I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
However, I violated one of my own kind of fundamental beliefs. And the problem was, is he believed that the market would retest the bottom. So when it started to run back up, we didn't get back in. Chris, as you probably know, most people that wrote it out were pretty much made whole within a few years.
Yes.
I mean, they weren't ahead of the game, but they regained most of their losses. We didn't get back in the market till much later. So I took his advice, but accept full responsibility for the decision to leave the market. I have never blamed. I basically have blamed him for bad advice, but I took responsibility for the decision that I made. Now, I made that decision. Nobody made me leave the market. He advised me to. I made that choice. And so I spent a long time kicking myself metaphorically in the rear end, you know, oh, you idiot, you dummy. And I realized that wasn't going to get my money back.
It didn't work?
No, it didn't work. No. And occasionally on a bad day, you know, I'll still kind of move that direction again, and I just say, you know, stop. And I realize it's behind me, and I go back to forget it, drive on. I mean, I've learned a few lessons, gotten a few insights. And now the only thing I can hope to influence and control is what I do going forward.
Mm, that's it. And when you spend all that time trying to blame somebody else for, you know, the decision that you made, all you're doing is just poisoning your own self.
I got a buddy who said his ex-wife spent the first 15 years after their divorce trying to make his life miserable. And I remember thinking, I wonder what her life might have been like if she'd spent the same energy trying to make her life better.
Right. No doubt. Ugh. Craziness. All right. Our last question comes from, and we always give him a hard time because his handle is Scrop, which is actually short for Sievercrop, Mark Sievercrop. But here's my question for Mark. First off, you've got a great first name, of course, Mark. Yes. My question is, I'm in the process of searching for job opportunities that will allow me to grow as a leader. What can I do to differentiate myself from other job seekers and develop my leadership abilities?
Well, Scrop, also known as Mark, I have sat across the desk from many job applicants and interviews, and I am always bewildered by how little they know about me, my business, or the position.
Mm.
If you want to demonstrate your potential ability as a leader, then do what all good leaders do and prepare thoroughly. Study the living daylights out of that company, that person, that position. Now, 20 years ago, that would have been easier said than done. But today, with the resources on the internet, you've got to be working for a top secret organization, or you've got to be interviewing at a top secret organization and not have reams of information about that person that's interviewing you in that organization. Now, the first step then is to prepare thoroughly by studying the organization. The second step is to ask yourself, what opportunities might I suggest based on what I've learned? And I think it's important to frame that up with the person that's interviewing you to simply admit, look, you know, I'm looking from the outside in, but as I think about your business, here are some ideas that I have. And you might even say, you know, maybe you're doing these things, maybe you've tried these things, maybe you don't ever want to try these things, but because I don't have access to that, the inner workings of your company, here's what strikes me as some great opportunities. And that will do more than anything to demonstrate, you know, your ability as a leader to fast forward and to think ahead, to come
Absolutely.
Up with solutions and not just spot problems.
Definitely. Oh, gosh. I mean, that's a breath of fresh air to see something like that.
Oh, yeah. I'd love it. I'd love it. And when I have seen it, I've almost always hired the person.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Will you hang around and answer a few questions for the folks at chrislicurto.com?
You bet. I'll be glad to.
How can people get more of you?
Well, they can go to marksanborn.com. That's the mothership. It's got all the buttons for Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. MarkSanborn.com, and I do hope that maybe they avail themselves to the blog that I write regularly, MarkSanborn.com/blog. And like I said, rather than confuse the issue with all of the other addresses, they can find the buttons for the other social media outlets at the website.
Excellent. They can get the books there as well.
You bet.
Excellent. Well, Mark, thank you again for coming and doing this, and we're going to hang out and do a little bit more. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Sanborn. Well, I am so excited that the chrislicurto.com readers got a chance to ask those questions. That was fun. That was good information. I think one of the things I love the most that he said was about hope. Gosh, aren't we all looking for hope? Hope is having something new to try and being willing to try it. Folks, in a day where so many of us are looking for hope, in a day where so many of us are wanting something different, something new, something exciting, here's the thing about hope. You can have a lot of ideas. You can have a lot of dreams. You can have a lot of things. But hope is having something new to try and being willing, put a circle around willing, to try it. Mefford, what'd you get out of that?
Well, you know, two things. I really loved his surfer metaphor that said we're all affected by waves we can't control, and we have to learn how to interact with them. We can't change the ocean. And sometimes it feels overwhelming, and you're always fighting against it, and sometimes you just need to learn how to react with it. I would almost say you need to be shrewd sometimes in the way you have to deal with certain issues or problems or challenges you have at work, and head on, facing those things head on sometimes is not the best option, but being shrewd in figuring out, you dive through the waves, or you kind of can swim around them to an extent, you know, like a good surfer would do.
Like in Point Break.
Like in Point Break. When Bodhi is in the plane and Keanu Reeves jumps out of the plane, I know that's not the surfer part, but that's the part I remember
absolutely,
always.
Absolutely.
Because I'm like, he just dove out of the plane without a parachute.
How is it that I'm the one who came up with the movie metaphor this time?
And very, very impressive. Hey, you know what else I liked?
What else did you like?
He said, you only get full credit when you take full blame.
Oh my gosh.
And isn't that true?
Oh my gosh.
Because we're always
so many
wanting
people
that appreciation.
Want the credit,
yes.
And they're not willing to take the blame. Maturity says, you know what? This is my fault. And when you're willing to do that, the credit's going to follow. Because nobody wants to give credit to somebody who doesn't take the blame for the bad stuff they did.
No. I sat in a meeting recently where I took the blame for something, and the guy who was responsible on my team was sitting in the room, and we were talking to somebody outside of our team. And so I knew he knew that he was responsible, but seeing me say, hey, it was my fault to this other leader, that only empowers him. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't demoralize him. And the truth is, it was my fault. Yeah, you know, as the leader, I should have known better. But
tell the truth. It wasn't a guy. It was Becky, wasn't it?
Well, I was trying to be easy on her, but
she can't even hear me in there, can she? Becky, you don't do anything wrong. You never do anything wrong. You're perfect.
Man,
you're fantastic.
Just ask her.
Oh.
That's why we don't give her a mic right now.
We don't give her a mic because we're afraid of what she's going to say about us. Oh, my gosh. Becky is amazing. I always say that. She's the amazing Becky. Coming up this Thursday at 9 a.m. Central, we'll be hosting the Entree Leadership Live Chat. Come stop by for an hour to kick off your workday and learn from fellow Entree leaders. You can even ask me or our team some of those business questions you've had on your mind. Did we mention that this is free? It's free. Totally free. Completely free. Unless you've got to pay for like dial-up or something just to get in on the call. I guess that wouldn't actually happen, would it? Go to DaveRamsey.com/EntreeLeadership this Thursday and join in on the discussion. Also, if you want to hear all of the Entree Leadership lessons from Dave, attend our next Entree Leadership Master Series event October 14th through the 20th in Orlando, Florida at Disney's Swan and Dolphin Resort. At this event, Dave will not only teach you how to take your business to the next level, but he will also personally interact with you over the course of the week-long event. The event is limited to only 200 seats. That's all we let in. Why? Because we want to keep it personal. We want to be able to spend that time with you. So, and it is selling. It's selling out. So make sure that you go to DaveRamsey.com, or I'm sorry, you can go to DaveRamsey.com or go to EntreeLeadership.com. That's going to get you there faster. And check out that information. And folks, once again, I will be there the whole week long, spending my time ripping your business apart. Hey, your business may be doing great, so maybe I will spend my time with you one-on-one in growing that business. Whatever your business need is, that is the thing that I do. I will spend my time teaching some of the lessons, but most of my time will be spent one-on-one coaching sessions growing businesses. Once again, that puts another Entree Leadership podcast in the books. I've got to thank the people who make this happen every single time. Chris Mefford, our producer. Colin Fatke, our audio engineer. Becky Powell, our queen of, what do we got here? Our queen of
surfing. With the surfing analogy and Point Break brought into this podcast.
Our queen of the surf. That was weak. We'll have to come up with something better next time.
What's a surfer? Yeah, that is weak.
Obviously, want to thank Mark Sanborn and, of course, Dave Ramsey. Folks, take this information out there. Change your life, change your leadership, change your business. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in on the next Entree Leadership Podcast.
Folks, right now is the best time in history to operate or start a small business. If you're ready to take your leadership to the next level or start your own company, then join me, Dave Ramsey, at Walt Disney World's Swan and Dolphin Resort on October 14th through the 20th for our Entree Leadership Master Series. At this event, I'll teach you everything you ever wanted to know about building and growing a profitable business. You'll also experience personal leadership coaching from our executive team. Folks, you won't find this stuff in some college business class. This is 20 years in the trenches of leading and actually running a business. It's based on my New York Times number one bestseller, Entree Leadership. So bring your spouse, bring your team, but you better hurry. These events are limited to only 200 people, and they always sell out early. Call the Entree Leadership team at 888-22-PEACE. That's 888-227-3223 or online at DaveRamsey.com.